Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Tuesday, July 10, 2018. Around the garden, the phlox flowers, the cone flowers, and shooting star are all in bloom. And finally, yesterday, I observed an abundance of honeybees. I also observed the first swallowtail butterfly of the year. The weather has been hot, and the weatherman says to expect storms today. As we get started today, I wanted to remind everyone that if you are interested in keeping up with this podcast, please do find our Facebook page called the Mark Fraley Podcast and like us. In this way, you will be assured of getting notices when new podcasts are posted. In the alternative, the Mark Fraley Podcast is on iTunes, and you can always subscribe and check for current shows on iTunes. As always, we love to hear your comments and suggestions for future shows. We can be contacted through our website at markfraley.com. People who are interested in the natural environment, parks, wildlife, and the outdoors can benefit from an awareness of the various organizations that are involved in advocacy for these interests. Let's face it, there are serious issues facing the health of our forest fields and streams. Changes in the landscape caused by man's activities can certainly have a detrimental effect. Wildlife and wild lands cannot advocate for themselves. On this podcast, we have interviewed several of the leaders involved in the conservation advocacy in Tennessee. Check the archives for interviews with Kathleen Williams of the Tennessee Parks and Greenways Association and with Stuart Clifton of the League of Conservation Voters. For many years, the Tennessee Wildlife Federation has played an important role in conservation and environmental advocacy in Tennessee. This group was formerly known as the Tennessee Conservation League. At its inception in the 1940s, it was involved with the creation of the Independent Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, TWRA. Today, it is among the most effective of our advocacy organizations. They have been recognized by the National Wildlife Federation as one of their outstanding organizations. They have a large membership located in every nook and cranny in Tennessee, and they maintain close relationships with members of the legislature. Yesterday, I had the good fortune to meet Mike Butler, the executive director of the Tennessee Wildlife Federation. As you will hear, Mike has a strong educational background in the science of wildlife management. He is quite an energetic leader and is extraordinarily knowledgeable in the public policy aspects. And so, I hope you'll enjoy this wide-ranging interview with Mike Butler. Mike Butler, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm over along the Richland Creek Greenway over here in West Nashville. I hadn't been in this building before. It's kind of a nice little space you have here.
I believe we've been here since 82. My predecessor, twice removed, Tony Campbell, was the executive director when the board purchased this property. And we own it free and clear, and we have the property next door, so we've got a little parking space. Gotcha. But we got Richland Creek, as you pointed out, right out the back door, and we've seen all kinds of wildlife out there the years.
I'll bet. Now, we're here at the headquarters of the Tennessee Wildlife Federation, an organization that used to be known as the Tennessee Conservation League back in the day.
That's correct.
Mike, you're the executive director.
Chief Executive Officer, Executive Director, take your pick.
Okay, excellent. Well, Mike, my listeners are from all over the place, and I like to start these interviews, and you typically interview people that are involved in conservation and the outdoors and that sort of thing, with a question about how they got to, professionally, to what they're doing, and what was the thing that got you interested in the outdoors and in conservation?
Well, that's funny. When I was growing up, my dad took me hunting and fishing, and so that was a big part of who I was growing up. I played a lot of football when I was in high school, middle school, And so those were the two interests that really captured my attention. And I went to the University of Tennessee thinking I wanted to be a civil engineer. And I worked for a civil engineer for a summer on a couple of bridge projects and decided I don't want to be a civil engineer. And then after that, I did a stint in architecture school for a year to a year and a half, and had an uncle that had been a very successful architect around the country, and had gone to that school. And I decided after working for an architecture firm, I'm not really cut out to be an architect. And so I just kind of went back to, what do I enjoy doing? What really has created an interest and a passion and a purpose for me? And it was the outdoors. So that, funny enough, I'd had an offer for a scholarship to forestry school when I started that I'd turned down.
At UT.
Okay,
all right.
And but I went into the wildlife program and finished up on a five-year plan, you know, after changing my major twice.
Gotcha.
And got into wildlife biology. And then I had one of my mentors in school there, Billy Menzer, who has been, he was with the university as a wildlife staffer in the Department of Wildlife and Fishery Sciences, actually stayed on me about doing an internship at the Wildlife Society in Washington.
Okay.
And so I left Knoxville, went straight to Manitoba, Canada, to work for Delta Waterfowl as one of their student researcher fellowships. Yeah. Left there and got the internship in D.C. with the Wildlife Society, where I met, at the time, Dr. Jim Teer, who was the Professor Emeritus of Wildlife at Texas A&M University.
Okay.
And the head of the board of the Robin Bessie Welder Wildlife Foundation.
Goodness.
And we wrote a proposal, and he funded all my graduate research at Montana State University in Bozeman. And then I finished that and came home and was literally digging ditches for my dad's company, putting in silt fence while I was publishing papers and finishing my thesis, and got a call in 1996 saying, hey, would you interview for this position? And that was the Tennessee Conservation League.
Terrific. Your little stint in Washington, I guess, gave you a little heads up as far as the public policy aspects of this business.
Gave me a big heads up.
Yeah.
About that. What,
yeah.
The most important thing I learned in Washington was I was walking around the halls of the U.S. Senate, and I passed Paul Simon, Senator Paul Simon. You remember, he's a very distinctive-looking individual.
From Illinois.
Yep. Yeah. And I sat there and had a conversation listening to him talk, and I had this realization that all these folks up here, you know, they're a lot of them are pretty smart, a lot of them are pretty talented, but they're no different than you or me in a large way. And so there's that kind of pulled the veil back for me, and I saw a lot of opportunity to bring whatever talents I had or had developed or was going to develop into the policy space as it relates to wildlife. Because back in those days, policy work in wildlife was just starting to really get going and cut its teeth. It was around that late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s that it started to really formulate into a solid approach to how do you do good wildlife conservation.
Well, you know that the Tennessee Conservation League and the Wildlife Federation in Tennessee have a stellar reputation for effective advocacy for the environment and for the outdoors. I can remember watching Tony Campbell at work down at the legislature, and he was truly a master down there. So you guys have a history of activity down there.
For 23 years, he did that work, and that was really his passion. I remember when I was a little tyke growing up, Tony used to sleep on the couch in my parents' house when he'd come through town, because my dad was a board member of the league in the mid-80s. So I'd come
Jackson,
by it, honest,
Tennessee.
In Jackson.
Yeah.
So all that being the case, Tony did have a reputation that preceded him, and a solid one. I mean, he did a lot of really, really strong work that most people will never know about. It's just very quietly
done. You know, back in the day, I worked at conservation, and we every 5 years had to do the state comprehensive outdoor recreation plan. And only, I would say a minor part of it is fishing and hunting, but some part of it is fishing and hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And we always included Tony, and he was always there at the table talking the business.
That's right.
And giving good advocacy. So it was important person to know. And Tony, if you're out there listening, say hello. It's good to. I wish I could see you more often. So, what are the issues today, Mike? That you're working on as far as future of wildlife in Tennessee. What are the issues that you see are the problems that you're dealing with?
It's really funny. I mean, some of them are no different than when you were doing the work in the business back in the 80s. I can go over across the hallway here into our closet and pull you a 1960s newsletter, and you can read it. It sounds like you're sure. talking about today.
Sure.
Now, there are some things that are very specific to right now that I can touch on. But in essence, some of the biggest challenges we have are around loss of habitat, which is something you could read for the last 100 years about in any publication. But more specifically about how we are dealing with open space habitat as it relates to open space, land use, land change. Those things are never going to go away. We're always going to have to be actively looking for opportunities to set aside the best places and find places for people to recreate. East Tennessee is blessed with a lot of public lands. We are not blessed with nearly as much public land in Middle Tennessee, a little bit more in West Tennessee, but for the growth that's occurring in Middle Tennessee, having a place for people to recreate is going to be a big deal.
Sure.
And that also applies to the habitat for the wildlife that attracts people to the outdoors. If we don't have healthy habitats, obviously you diminish the quality of the experience for the individual, right. whether they're floating, whether they're doing this, that, the other. Now, as far as some of the more poignant problems that are on our doorstep. People have probably heard about feral or wild hogs. They've also heard about Asian carp, which is a big, big issue. That particular issue...
You must have seen my checklist today.
No, but I'm telling you, we can circle back to that one because it's a show in of itself. Invasive exotic species in general, whether it's forest pests, whether it's plants, whether it's wildlife that are invasive, that are non-native to the United States, like Asian carp being from China, escaping aquaculture facilities in Arkansas, now populating everything up to the Duck River, all the way over to Nickajack, right. next to Chattanooga. Some scary, scary stuff, and we frankly just don't have the resources within our natural resource agencies to really get after and address these adequately. You add to that, there is an initiative that Governor Haslam started roughly 6 months ago called the Tennessee H2O Initiative. Mm-hmm. That is a comprehensive approach to water availability and health. And we are playing a significant role in that.
Protection of the watershed so that they will be available.
Well, yeah, and it's really looking at... There are about five areas that it's evaluating.
Okay.
One is natural resources, tourism, and recreation, which we're in a leadership role there as an organization. We have also this, there's groundwater being looked at, water law, infrastructure, and surface water. And so when we say comprehensive, the idea is what are the things we need to be focused on for the next 20 years to really nail down that we're going to have healthy and abundant water? Because if you look at other states around us, like Georgia, their agriculture interest in South Georgia over this recent ruling by the Supreme Court,
right.
they can't get water to irrigate with.
Right. You're speaking of the recent ruling out of the Florida-Georgia case.
That's right.
Right.
Correct.
For the Apalachicola watershed.
Well, and we've also have Georgia looking at trying to gain our
exactly.
water
from the Tennessee River.
From the Tennessee River and Mississippi. We are currently in a lawsuit with Mississippi over the aquifer under Memphis. And as you know, when states
that.
File suits against each other, it goes directly to the Supreme Court.
Right.
You get a special master right. and you run through all that stuff. So, you know, I would say the land use piece, the invasive exotics, the water issues are the big, you know, 60,000 foot level types of groups of issues that are things that we're going to have to stay focused on. There are a lot of tentacles of where that intersects daily life for citizens in Tennessee. On the land use place, it's about having a place to hunt and fish. It's about having a quality set of habitats that provide for healthy and abundant wildlife so that wildlife watchers, anglers, hunters can all enjoy it, right? And then on the flip side of that, you've got the water pieces. The water pieces are around recreation as well. There are all these different connectivity points, which is why we spend a lot of time at the General Assembly and working with state agencies. I will point out this, from a philosophical point, where we really engage the most are on those resources that are owned by the public. And in Tennessee, for us, it's primarily in air and water. Water is not privately owned. Now, the land underneath some of the water can be privately owned. Sure. A lot of it is publicly owned. But wildlife are publicly owned, held in trust by the state for the citizens. Same with water. And so you have all this infrastructure and government built up around that. You have laws that to protect water, protect wildlife. You have agencies whose whole role it is to protect the public interest in those things. So we find that we can leverage that work much more highly by working in the policy space with those agencies and with all the public entities that address and work on those types of issues, as much as we can when we go do stewardship work through our Wetland In Lieu Fee program, which actually does wetland restoration. So we come at things really from a three-legged stool, if you would.
Okay.
We have our advocacy and conservation policy work. I like to call that applied conservation policy advocacy. So you have that kind of world. And then you have our work around stewardship, which is largely based on habitat restoration. Wetlands, streams.
You have a conservation division here.
We're not big enough to have a division, but we have staff that have a lot of years of experience that run that program.
Okay.
And then we have a big part of what we do is youth engagement. Most of the floor in this second floor of this building is dedicated to youth engagement and stewardship. So, and policy, I guess, all our program stuff's here, but mostly youth engagement staffing. And that would include everything from our Scholastic Clay Target program and our Youth Hunting and Fishing program to our Hunters for the Hungry program that has the Hunger Challenge component in schools that work with high school clubs. The point being, if you look at those three areas, you have to have citizens that are informed to make good policy decisions through the voting booth, through advocacy, whatever. But you've also got to have good policy to make sure you've got places for people to play. And then you've got to have healthy places for people to play through the stewardship. So it feeds itself in a loop. So
Mike, what do we know about the level of sophistication or awareness that the common citizen has about the very problems that you've talked about? You've talked about the degradation of habitat, you've talked about the invasive species, those sorts of issues. What does the general public know about? I mean, my experience is that legislators really are no better informed than the general public for the most part.
In as much as they're representatives of the general public, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I would say this, it depends on whether it's happening to you or not.
Okay.
If you are living on Kentucky Lake and you are having to deal with Asian carp getting into your boat, whether you're trying to ski, fish, or just float, then you're very informed and you're pretty upset. If it's the broader piece of how is our water quality doing around the state, it's not nearly as informed, because that's much more technical and it's much more place-based. However, you can have that. We've got an email this morning about people getting concerned about that they're getting sick from high bacteriological levels on a certain lake in Tennessee.
Okay.
So if it's affecting you, sure, you're going to feel it and hear it, and the legislators will feel and hear that too. On the flip side, there are a lot of things that are much more like the old story where you turn the heat up on the frog in the pot slowly, and you lose things, or you start to see a degradation in things, and by the time you figure it out, we're really concerned. But there's a whole bunch of time before that where people really aren't, that they think they may see something. I'll give you an example. For that in Middle Tennessee, it's the wild turkey population.
Well, tell me what you mean.
People are very concerned that we've got a significant decline in wild turkeys in Middle Tennessee.
Okay.
And nobody can really put their finger on what's causing it. Now, bird biology, I'm a waterfowl biologist by training. I can tell you it's pretty simple. You have to have enough nests hatch young birds, and you have to have enough young birds survive to replace the older birds that are taken out of the population. There's a whole lot of factors that go in to affect that on the ground. However, TWRA is concerned enough that they put together a five-year joint study with UT to really, and this, we're not the only state in the South that's dealing with this. Mississippi, parts of Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama are still looking at that.
Well, but, speaking of awareness, yeah. I was unaware of that.
Exactly.
So
unless you're a turkey hunter going around and you don't see Jakes and you don't see Toms and you're spending a lot of time covering ground and you're not affected,
right.
It's very quiet, very slow.
Yeah, I got down to Tim's Ford recently and was chased around by a flock of about 50 wild turkeys. So
yeah.
I didn't realize that there was an issue there.
There is an issue.
Okay.
We don't know how big of an issue it is.
Okay.
I mean, there are a lot of things that are being looked at and considered.
Right.
We just know that there are enough people spending enough time on the landscape to come back and say, hey, we're not seeing what we used to see.
You know, I told you before we got started that I recently interviewed Dwight Estes about his grasslands conservation mm-hmm. efforts. And it occurs to me to ask you about bobwhite quail. And the issues that we're still having with bobwhite quail. Are we doing any better with that?
There are success stories,
okay.
Quite a few. Will we ever get back to what was around in the 1950s? Don't know.
Okay.
If you look at the landscape and how it was utilized in those days versus now, you had very inefficient family farms with lots of hedgerows, lots of disturbance on the landscape vegetatively.
Right.
You didn't have nearly as many forests. You had a lot more grassland, a lot more rough areas. And quail, you had a lot more people on the landscape, too, controlling predators. And so you take all that and you put it in a basket, shake it up. It's a wonderful place for quail to be. Nowadays, we have a lot more forest than we did back then.
Right.
We've done a great job of restoring forests. We've got over half the state forested now, and it's slowly increasing still.
Right.
In addition to that, we don't have as many people on the landscape. We have a lot more nest predators than we used to, just in sheer volumes
coyote and...
Well, coyote's not so much.
Okay.
Fox will actively hunt hens on nests. They'll eat the hen, they'll eat all the eggs. But really, the ones that we're seeing more concern about are possum, skunk, and raccoons.
They eat eggs.
Well, they eat eggs, and it's not that... No wild bird, I mean, no predator makes a living eating eggs.
Okay.
It's like ice cream. It's only available 90 days out of the year, maybe tops, even if a bird re-nests.
Gotcha.
So evolutionarily speaking, from a survivability standpoint, it's only available for a short window of time, but we have so many of these types of critters on the ground these days because of how we have changed the landscape with abandoned buildings and culverts and places for den sites. That just the sheer numbers of them on the landscape, they're bound to run into nests.
Fascinating.
Now, you take that and you change the habitat to large, you know, plantings of fescue and things like that, and there's certain structural aspects of habitat that have changed,
right.
And you end up in a situation where quail don't do that well. So there are success stories.
To make the point for you, the fescue grasses are European grasses for the most part, and not adapted for quail.
They're cool season grasses,
right.
So they grow better in the fall and spring. What we have native to Tennessee that Dwayne, I'm sure, gave you a crash course PhD
That's right.
Is the native warm season grasses like big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, all those. Those are bunch grasses,
right.
And their structure is fundamentally different, and they have better, in a lot of cases, better value for wildlife because of how they allow young birds to move in and out of them rather than being
places.
Yeah, well, that and the ability to escape predators.
Right.
Right. So where we see quail doing well is where people are spending a lot of time and effort trying to get the habitat right, and they're also working on making sure that predator populations are in balance.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So interesting. Talk about songbirds a little bit.
Well, Tennessee is blessed by its position geographically and by the forest we have to have a lot of unique songbirds. I am not a songbird expert. I'm a songbird fan.
Right.
I can tell you that we have some of the most important songbirds from a conservation standpoint, and the cerulean warbler, the golden wing warbler. We get as many warblers through here probably as any state in the union on their way to the Caribbean and other places where they winter, Mexico, places like that, even further south. There was a great initiative in the 90s called Partners in Flight that came together to produce plans on how to conserve songbirds. And I'll say this, we don't have the resources at our disposal for our wildlife agency to really manage towards the needs of songbirds. So there's this is a great segue. There's a big piece of legislation right now in Congress called the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. And that act, they asked the question, Mark, they said, every state has what is called a state wildlife action plan that was a requirement created by the federal government for state agencies to produce back in the early 2000s. And as a result, they said, well, what would it cost to fund the implementation of every state wildlife action plan in the union? And the answer was $1.3 billion on an annual recurring basis. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is.
Yeah.
Compared to what it costs to deal with critters that go on the Endangered Species Act, it's a drop in the bucket on that list. If they get on the list, Katie bar the door. In $1990, the Spotted Owl Recovery Plan cost the government $4 billion, and it cost the economy of the Northwest $44 billion. So our approach is we want to see cooperative conservation, where you have the funding like the $1.3 billion, Tennessee would get $21 million. We would match that with another 25%. So you're talking in the neighborhood of $28 to $30 million that you would use proactively to manage for non-game wildlife, or wildlife that aren't hunted and fished, to ensure that they don't have declines in their populations that would make them a candidate for being listed.
Now, so, from what I've read about that, I think the vision is for that to be funded through revenues that come to the government from offshore oil leases and that sort of thing.
The royalties off of offshore and onshore public lands, oil and gas leases.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of those, of course, go to the Land and Water Conservation Fund today.
Thanks to Senator Alexander in the 1990s.
Exactly. So I take this opportunity to encourage my listeners to get on the website of your website, the Tennessee Wildlife Federation website, and browse through the public policy elements that they have there that's highly informative. And I believe that there's actually a link in your webpage to the Tennessee Wildlife Agency's plan that you were just referencing.
State Wildlife Action Plan.
That's right.
Yep. There's also an area.
SWAP is what people call it.
Right. There's also an area. We've also launched an effort with the Wildlife Agency called the Tennessee Alliance for America's Fish and Wildlife,
okay,
which is part of the campaign effort to pass this legislation. And if you go to that section of the website, you can enter in your contact information, and we regularly kind of keep people in the loop as to what's going on with the legislation.
What's going on with surface mining these days?
It's funny you mention that.
Okay.
When you were in state government, I think the governor at the time sent surface mining management to the federal government.
Yes, we lost primacy.
Well,
yeah,
they brought it back. They brought it back.
Have they?
Okay. Last year,
okay.
And it is going to be, in my opinion, a mess. Not because it's going to go create a bunch of new mining opportunities. It's because I think that there's challenges with the way that the legislation was written that it's going to be very difficult to implement it,
right.
Number one. Number two, they said that it wasn't going to cost the state hardly any money. Well, guess what? It's going to cost them a ton of money to implement this law.
Curiously, I wonder because I don't know the answer to this. I wonder if the Haslam administration was for this or against it.
I don't remember. I don't believe that they were. They had taken a position. I believe that they were neutral, but don't. I mean, I'm not sure. I know that it was not an administration bill.
Right.
It was a bill brought by the Tennessee Mining Association.
So the very beginning of the Alexander administration, the surface mining division was so poorly managed, and such a political football. That we were really glad to see the mm-hmm. federal government take primacy, because we could have adequate regulation and wouldn't have to bother us. So we're back. And where's that going to be located in state government?
I believe it would be at TDEC.
Okay.
Now, I will say this. It may have, if there is a silver lining, and I'm not certain there is, it might be that we would be able to access a larger pool of funds to address pre-Surface Mining Reclamation Act mines. So there was, as you know, there was a bill in the 1970s called the Surface Mining Reclamation Act that set up a path forward for how you were going to take
the orphan mines and all
that mines that had been abandoned that were creating acid mine drainage into waters of the state and fix those so they were no longer a environmental disaster on the landscape. The Office of Surface Mining within the federal government has been largely involved in helping find those monies. But as you know, there are two pools of money, one for states that don't have primacy, one for states that do. And the ones that have the pool of money for states that do is larger. So maybe we can pull down more of that money, but that's a speculation on my part.
So what if we can peer into the hearts of our legislature, would motivate them to want to regain primacy?
Don't know they were told the truth when it boils down to it. Right. And I would say that, yeah, I'm saying it publicly. Yeah. I wouldn't back down from that. Sometimes things happen for reasons that don't make a lot of sense. I think this was one of those.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. We try not to be ultra political here on this program.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's just being as factual as possible. I know that when we were looking around that, there were things unrelated to that piece of legislation that were driving the momentum behind that.
Okay. Let's talk just for a second about...
One last thought on the mining stuff. I think it's important maybe for your listeners to understand that Tennessee is in the lowest of the top of the 50 states or whatever number of states we have that mine coal. We're in the bottom 1 to 2. We have never historically been a large coal producing state. And so for our aspect, it isn't about to coal mine or not to coal mine. That's not the issue. For us, it's about what's the better use for the public and for the private interest in the area in terms of what's going to help the economy and the environment. So if you have an area that could be a strip mine, and it could produce a certain amount of revenue for a company to go in and do that. Well, what if that area is also a great location for outdoor recreation that would be much more sustainable? Now, sometimes it's not mutually exclusive.
Right.
But we know that we have 25,000 people a year going up to look at the elk that we helped reintroduce in the North Cumberlands. And so where you might use, there's a common theme that says you can use remining to fix some of the pre-bad mining practices, that could be something we would support. But on the flip side of that, there are other places where you go in and you mine off the top of this particular mountain or the side of this particular mountain, and you could be impacting things that would come down to bite you, like cerulean warbler habitat or Indiana bats that are endangered. You know, there's a trade-off, and I think our point is that we're such a marginal producing state for coal that the trade-off on water and wildlife and habitat and outdoor recreation primarily is something that needs a stronger look.
You know, there's been a lot of this talks. A lot of this is all about water quality. Certainly the surface mining, but there's also a water quality component to forestry management.
That's right.
And there's been controversy about forestry harvesting practices, the clear cut, as it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Are we making any progress along those lines?
When I first got here in 96, we used to see 3 to 5 bills a year around forest management practices. And then several things happened that I think helped alleviate that. One is you had the Master Logger Program, which came in and started incentivizing people to do things right. We helped write and pass the Bad Actor Forestry legislation in the early 2000s.
Tell me what that is.
Well, that if you have a forestry operation that is not following best management practices and creates a pollution event that is identifiable, then the Commissioner of Environment Conservation can go in and shut down that operation and make them fix it. So the argument was at the time is, look, a lot of foresters are doing things the right way. And we encourage people, if you're gonna manage the timber on your property or manage the forest on your property, you need to get a certified forester, a professional that has gone through silvicultural training, because they can improve not only the sale price of your forest products, they can also set you up for much healthier habitat and much healthier water and things like that. So when you look at that, the other factors that really helped to reduce that number of pieces of legislation, I think those were big ones. And then certification programs. You saw the private market come to bear through the Forest Stewardships Certification Program and the Sustainable Forestry Initiative Certification Program.
So this is where the purchasers of lumber are wanting to know where they're getting their wood from and if it's harvested.
So if you go to Lowe's or Home Depot, and in either one of those stores, you walk in and you'll look, and there's several types of certification programs. The good news is that the science and the biology behind most of them are almost identical.
Okay.
But if you go in and you see a little Sustainable Forestry Initiative logo on the product, whether it's paper, wood, raw wood, or whatever, then or a Forest Stewardship Council certification emblem, then you'll know from looking at that that there is a chain of custody from a well-managed forest to the end point at the retailer.
Right. I guess that the concern early was, I mean, that the silvicultural practices, that's harvesting of trees and such as that, managing of forests, were exempt from the Clean Water Act initially.
Still are.
Yeah. And so here we have, although they may still be exempt, we still have progress happening in terms of...
We do, and again, it goes back to that cooperative approach. In other words, the Bad Actor Forestry Bill was largely based on how do you focus on the bad actors. Not everybody's doing it wrong. So if you do something that cuts across the board, then you could be penalizing people that are trying to do it right, and you're disincentivizing them to want to be a cooperative partner. So we looked at it and said, look, let's go after the ones that are not doing it right, and let's hold them accountable. And so that's where that bill came from.
So one of my interests in outdoor, the subject of the outdoors, is invasive exotic plants.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed recently that Metro Nashville has made part of Warner Park a new feature on the other. I don't know if you're familiar with the new area of Warner Park.
I am. Across the highway there?
Across the highway from the main part of Warner
Basically Park. Between Highway 70 and Highway 100.
That's right.
Stretches
it's
across
old hill
the,
property.
That's right.
And it's a beautiful piece of property.
Full of ticks.
That's probably right, and some great big trees back there, but it's also loaded with honeysuckle, and other invasive exotic plants.
And I would garner to say privet,
oh,
and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah. Are we working at all on advocacy to get a method or some sort of handle on these invasive exotic plants in our landscapes? And obviously, they degrade the landscape as far as as wildlife habitat.
I think, I don't know that there are efforts underway through private organizations, through public agencies. I don't know that it is, it's almost on a whack-a-mole approach. if you will. You have a lot of wild hogs in an area. We put together a pretty effective 23-member coalition called the Wild Hog Eradication Action Team, or WHEAT. And you know, most of the on-the-ground work was done by the Wildlife Resources Agency. But in the end, the goal was to have a singular focus on managing those into extinction if possible, because right. they're so destructive.
Right.
I think we're going to see something similar around carp. I think when you get to plants, you know, it's a little bit more difficult. We've seen efforts by different groups on the hemlock woolly adelgid. We've seen it on the gypsy moth. I don't know that it's as coordinated as it could be in terms of effort, and I don't think we have the financial resources at hand to really get after it.
I would cause you to pay attention to what's happening at Radnor Lake if you have not paid attention there. Over the last 10 or 15 years, they have done a terrific job in getting rid of some of that stuff out there. And it is really showing.
Well, they got a tremendously strong fringe group, too.
Well, that's exactly. And it's not free. And mm-hmm. it takes a lot of volunteer hours, and yeah. it takes persistence. They have to stay after it.
Yeah, very true.
But it is showing positive results with the reemergence of certain of the ephemeral wildflowers and all that sort of stuff that you would
that
love,
are still
love
in the
see.
Seed bank, but
exactly.
just getting released.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
pretty neat.
What other positive or you talked about the elk, and that's mm-hmm. a terrific example of a positive something going on in the wildlife today. Anything else going on that's positive that we should know about?
Well, positive. Let me think. I hate to be so slow to react to that question. We have some amazing fisheries in Tennessee. Chickamauga Lake just got put on the top three, one of the top three bass fishing lakes in the country. We have amazing trout fisheries from the Caney Fork, all the tailwater fisheries in East Tennessee. The Hiwassee is an unbelievable fisheries resource. We have fantastic trophy cat fishing opportunities for people that like to do that kind of thing. We have an improving deer herd. Over the last 15 years, we're seeing, I mean, we've got a new world record out of Sumner County, Tennessee, the non-typical world record, 319 3/8, I believe.
That made the school. News worldwide,
I think it did, and I'm a professional member of the Boone and Crockett Club, and people were just kind of taken aback by the fact that coming from little old Tennessee, we had a world record pop out that was just
mammoth.
And there are a lot of TWRA put together a board of some of the biggest and best white-tailed deer that they've seen taken in the state. It was really fantastic. So that, you know, from a positive standpoint on wildlife, we're really happy to see those. Waterfowl. Depending on the weather patterns a lot, I mean, we've done well with recovering waterfowl populations since the mid-90s. A lot of that has to do with weather, but our folks at TWRA have done a good job of having places for them to winter.
Exactly.
I would tell you that one of the biggest concerns we have around wildlife specifically is chronic wasting disease with deer. We don't have it in Tennessee, at least to this point. We don't know that we have it. We've been doing a lot. The agency's been doing a lot of testing. We have supported the agency implementing different rules and regs to control the flow of deer or elk or moose that are harvested outside the state coming into the state, so that you minimize, if not remove, the chance of carrying those infected proteins called prions into the state. To me, chronic wasting disease is the greatest threat to modern wildlife management and the whole system of management that we have. It's one of our greatest success stories in the recovery of the white-tailed deer. This thing could unravel that completely.
And as far as a deer that's infected with it, there's no curing it.
There's no known cure. It is 100% fatal. There is no reliable live test.
Right.
It can take years upon years to express itself. So you can have a deer that looks apparently healthy shedding these infective proteins into the soil, and we know now that certain plants can uptake those proteins, those misshaped prions into their plant matter and make themselves bioavailable as a food source. So we have a pretty extensive coverage of this on our website. There's another website I would point your listeners to called the CWD Alliance. It's cwd-alliance.org. It's great. It's a great site. Has most up-to-date information. We support them. Okay. I would say, too, that things that are affecting fish and wildlife from a regulatory standpoint that we worked on is that there was a successful attempt to weaken the concentrated animal feeding operation regulations, and we kept that from becoming an absolute removal. We were able to maintain those regulations on large swine and cattle feeding operations, which is better than nothing. And it was a uphill battle, and to keep that was a pretty big deal, but we were successful in that. And then a couple other pieces.
That really is about water quality.
It's about water quality, but in our book, that affects fish and all kinds of stuff. And recreation. I mean, we've got some overcrowding issues on different rivers and streams that are being loved to death in Middle Tennessee, and we're going to have to face how we manage that use. We were able to pass a piece of legislation that gives the Wildlife Commission the authority to regulate commercial canoe and kayak livery operators. And I think what that's going to look like moving forward is really sitting down with that community, with the fishing community, angling community, and saying, all right, look, we only have this water. We got to learn how to share it better.
You know, I'm surprised that there hasn't been that regulation up to now. I was most familiar with what goes on at the Ocoee, mm-hmm. and because of the nature of that tract of land was Forest Service, everybody had to have a license to be there.
That's right.
So
they figured that out after a certain period of time, and they put all the pieces and parts in control.
True in the Duck River and
the explosion of personal kayaks and really the advent. Remember, it used to be just tip a canoe over here on the Harpeth.
Right.
Well, now you've got Canoe the Caney. You've got all kinds of different companies that are just popping up. Yeah. And what's happening is they're getting on our public ramps and excluding other users from being able to get to the water as effectively. It's creating a lot of conflict. So we're
not to mention degrading the stream.
Potentially, I mean, if you get a lot of garbage, a lot of trash, litter, things like that.
Down the sandbars, and you're disturbing the mussels in the stream and all that sort of stuff.
And so we're optimistic that we can bring everybody together to try to find some solutions around that. And then I think the one piece that we were brought in, I think, late on is, and this is one of those things that you asked about earlier that you don't see it, but it has a profound impact, and that is stormwater runoff.
Sure.
When it rains in the city, on all this pavement we've got, all that water carries stuff into our streams, which carry it into our rivers. Stormwater management is where you slow that stuff down before it gets to the stream, and you drop out all the nasty stuff out of it and get it at least somewhat cleaner before it goes into the stream. We've had a pretty significant assault on stormwater regulations in the last 2 years in Tennessee,
two to three in the legislature,
and we did lose some of the stormwater protections we've had, so that's something that we're trying to keep an eye on to address.
Well, I think my listeners need to pay attention to what their legislators have to say about these issues. We have a difficult environment in our Tennessee State Legislature right now for protecting the environment.
We've got a situation when we lost one of our best champions this last week, Representative Lana Lawler, who was the chairman of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources.
From the Memphis area.
He was the subcommittee chairman, and that was a very, very important position. I would say this, we have a lot of legislators that do care deeply about the great outdoors. The challenge is getting these issues into the discussion around things when they're having to deal with education, economic development, take the issue du jour. I mean, you can come up with anything, you know, healthcare access. I mean, those things can dominate the plate. And and our rural legislators are typically very, very receptive to what we're talking about. And in some of the urban ones are as well. I think that the challenge is making sure that these folks know that a lot of their constituents care. We have 1.2 million hunters and anglers in Tennessee. That's about, you know, we have 6.5 million people. Sure. So it's a significant percentage.
Exactly.
Now, you add to that the people that like to go out and canoe and kayak and powerboat and ski and birdwatch, and it becomes a formidable economic engine with a formidable population of people behind it. And so we're constantly trying to find ways to make our organization use science-based information to inform folks that are concerned about these things to engage. And what I like to say to people that are interested, I'm like, look, either this stuff matters to you or it doesn't. And if it does, then we want you to come alongside us and help us go achieve these things. Because the reason we have Warner Parks, the reason we have Radnor Lake, the reason we have all these great state forests, the reason we have all these great reservoirs isn't by accident. People made really important decisions years ago that resulted in these resources. The reason we have so many deer and turkey isn't by accident. The reason we have elk is not by accident. The reason you can catch a 20-inch brown trout on the Caney Fork isn't by accident. There's a whole lot of work, effort, and time that goes into making that happen.
Excellent. Yeah, Mike, we're at the end of our time.
Yeah, man.
I sure do thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks. I'd love to come back anytime.
Thanks.
Yep.